Hello and welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, the local site covering the Chicago White Sox on behalf of Baseball Prospectus. I'm Nick Schaefer, co-editor-in-chief, and this is a New York episode, really. I'm recording in Manhattan, New York, and I'm joined today by Frank Furke, who is out in Brooklyn. How are you doing, Frank?
Pretty good. I'm going to take this opportunity to bring up one of my pet peeves about the typical intro, which is that you and Colin always say joined as always by, and it's not as always. It's just, you know, most frequently by.
So I didn't, oh, does he, that's interesting. I don't think I did that today. I think I just.
No, you didn't.
All right. That is good to know. I'm also always torn as to whether or not to tell people who are already listening to the podcast how to find it. That seems to be automatic for most podcasts that I listen to, but You that seems like a tautology a little bit, you know. Hey, person who's listening to this, let me teach you how to listen to it. I guess I should request rates and reviews if you love banter like this and White Sox content. It's Sunday, what is this, the 17th of December. It's been a weird off season, I feel like. Has it been a weird off season?
Yeah. I mean, I've been not as in the loop just for a variety of reasons, but it definitely feels like there were two transactions that were both, like, the two big ones have been, like, much less exciting than in years past. Like, I found it really hard to get hyped for the Stanton deal, and I'm excited for to see what Ohtani does, but I don't find the actual, didn't find the sweepstakes interesting at all. And I was, I think, kind of irritated by the fact that people were talking about how I think the discourse was definitely excessively influenced by the fact that he was signing an amateur deal. And so that made it harder. Like, he's going to be a very good player, but the primary reason he's interesting is that he's a very good player getting signed to a cheap deal. And that, I think, I found pretty irritating.
Yeah.
And then after that, I don't, like, it's been a lot of, you know, not super big names getting shuffled around, except for, I guess, the Marlins guys, so.
Yeah, there's the Ohtani process. I was really glad that it was over because, like you said, I didn't find the process that interesting, other than the fact that it was a bidding war predicated on primarily non-monetary factors, which I guess is kind of interesting because you get people speculate about those sorts of things when really highest bidder is the primary driving force between the overwhelming majority of free agent signings. So it was kind of cool to see that warped a little bit. It was definitely unusual, but I got tired of it really quickly and just wanted to know where he'd go. Like you said, the sweepstakes component was not super intriguing to me.
Also wasn't any transparency in, like, it'd be cool if I got to actually, like, if someone, you know, every so often you get the, like, fly on the wall of, you know, like the, like draft day in the NFL or whatever, that someone gets to write those articles like inside the war room. And I'd love to get that in a couple years, like, you know, the oral history from the Ohtani people and, you know, why they actually picked Anaheim and how they winnowed it down and what they were concerned about. But it's one of those things where nobody's going to be honest or transparent. And so what's interesting about, like, oh, I don't want to play there because, you know, it'd be like particularly hard to be Japanese in that city or whatever, you're not going to get. And that's what I'd be a lot more interested in than, you know, something else.
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing a Kevin Costner film of this whole thing, I suppose. But
well, I think we need the Angels to trade Ohtani and then somehow get him traded back, but with, like, more assets along with him. Isn't that what happens in that movie?
I never actually saw it. I read a recap of it, and it sounded like it would drive me crazy because it's not... It's making this front office, I guess it's supposed to be like a hagiography of this fictional front office, but they're really just doing a lot of unnecessarily complicated and kind of dumb stuff. But
that's pretty indistinguishable from nonfiction.
But the other component too that was very frustrating is that it really doesn't take long for people to get either accidentally or not so accidentally racist when talking about Japanese players. It gets really tedious really quickly for me. So I was pleased to see where he wound up. I had sort of been pushing them, the Angels, as a dark horse candidate, as a great fit for him for since I think about a month beforehand. So I'm going to pat myself on the back on that. I didn't have any inside info. It was just purely like on the field who would benefit the most from him. And I think the Angels are a pretty obvious fit in that respect. They definitely have the at bats to give him, and they, oh my God, do they need whatever innings they can get. So that was fun to an extent. The Stanton deal was just was so depressing. It was that whole the Ozuna trade looks a lot more like a normal rebuilding team selling, oh, he's only got 2 years left on his contract, so we'll trade him for a couple interesting prospects. And Alcantara and Magnarius Sierra are seem to be legitimate prospects, so that's less depressing, I suppose, even if it's not necessarily fair value for Ozuna. That's hard to say. But the and the D. Gordon thing, it was a little hard to get too annoyed by, because I just don't think D. Gordon's that significant a player. Like, he's fine. Is the Stanton one just really was very grim to me.
Yeah, since I feel like I've seen at least a dozen, like, all the Star Wars movies ranked, I'm looking forward in 10 or 15 years to having a long enough, like, I guess you could already do it now, but it would be a little too short, of like catastrophic Marlins teardowns ranked. Because I think we're on number 4. Like, two of World Series winning teams and two of not actually all that great teams, but you have there's the Burley Reyes one, there's this one, there's the like Sheffield Piazza post World Series one, and there's the like Willis Cabrera, all those guys.
Yeah, this there were obviously the World Series ones were kind of the most dramatic because they have the highest peaks. And it's been kind of this rolling rebuild, other than, like you said, the Burley, Reyes, et cetera, one. I think it's just so disappointing to see. You're saying to yourself, okay, maybe they just once they get a new stadium, they can start to, do a reset, actually invest in the team after they got $2 billion or whatever from taxpayers, and to build this, by all accounts, a nice stadium, but they botched the location, and then they. Hit the eject button as soon as it didn't work out immediately. And then it's just sort of been this rolling rebuild. You wonder what could have been if, like last year, if Jose Fernandez is alive and Wei-Yin Chen does like a normal Wei-Yin Chen season, that might be a playoff team. But you'd hoped, okay, you hoped the new stadium might fix it. That didn't. You'd hoped maybe new ownership would fix it, and that clearly didn't. So I just don't know. It isn't an organization where you have this entrenched fan base of generations, right? Like if you were a Cubs fan who's our age, even when things are going really badly, you probably had some family or friend connections whose loyalties go back generations to sort of anchor you to it. The Marlins have never existed as anything other than this sort of shell of a team that isn't really competing in good faith most of the time, it feels like. And I was excited to see a changeover there until I saw what that changeover would look like, and it's pretty dark. So the fact that he went to the Yankees that as well is just like I understand. It sounds like that's the place Stanton wanted to go. That was possible. And so that's good. Like I'm glad that he is able to use his collectively bargained rights effectively to get himself in a situation that he prefers. That's good, but it's just the Yankees were already set up so well, and this is just obscene. So, great, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I guess all else equal, it's fun that the guy that cranks dingers is gonna be in a ballpark that is amenable to cranking dingers. I agree with all the people who want there to be like one of these, massive adult sons getting traded to Colorado.
Right? Yeah, that was definitely a hope.
Can't we get the Rockies to trade for some of these guys? Especially because the Rockies are, decent.
Yeah, and I think if I'm not mistaken, they could still use like they definitely have a room to upgrade at say first base. So, even if you I don't know, I mean
Right,
that's
whatever it is that you were intending, wherever it is that you were intending to have Ian Desmond play, like.
Yeah, I mean, if Ian Desmond's just your super utility guy, he's obviously really expensive, but that seems like a lot better than playing him as a regular. And maybe Schwarber to first base there would be a fun fit.
That would be.
Just because it's not Schwarber's fault that he got so overhyped, but he's clearly a square peg, and there isn't a square slot to put him in on that Cubs roster. So, and maybe, I know there's the best shape of his life story on him this offseason, so maybe we'll see if he can move around a little better in left, but it just feels like a waste of resources. And frankly, if I'm not mistaken, apparently the Cubs traded Gleyber Torres for 20 innings of Chapman because they didn't want to trade an injured Kyle Schwarber for Andrew Miller, which feels, if that's accurate, if they were just between A and B like that, that feels like a pretty catastrophic mistake. But yeah, what do I know?
I mean, I think we've talked about this before, that they have acted in their evaluation of Schwarber consistently with sort of like what they're on the record saying, right? That there are teams that don't hype up all their prospects, and they have really let the hype around Schwarber built up, which is fine, but they also act like they believe it, which is, again, fine. They're pros. But
Yeah, that's fair.
It is a little bit striking because you're used to hearing, there's teams where most teams don't get as positive about their prospects in such a sort of they don't let the same sort of articles get written about how, the scout is what the scout says he's the best pure hitter he's seen as an amateur ever or whatever. And like those don't typically leak out.
Yeah, you're right. It is interesting that you do have this prospect hype, but they don't seem to be using it for negotiation leverage. They just really like this guy that they drafted. So yeah, that's I guess I don't know if the Marlins are still going to trade Yelich at this point. I haven't looked at their updated. I could pull up their financial commitments because I know the number they said they wanted to get down to was like $55 million.
Jesus.
They were at 115 million in opening day last year. And with all those guys gone, they're currently, I think this still has them committed to 96 million for next year. If you trust their COTS arbitration estimates of about $17 million. And I feel like people have the arb numbers pretty down at this point. I think that most estimates are pretty solid.
Yeah, I don't. There aren't big misses on the ARB projections, I don't think.
So maybe they can trade Chen or Prado or I guess Brad Ziegler would probably be easy to move. 1 year at $9 million, Brad Ziegler is probably fine. But oh, and this
They
still ha
outfield a team next year, though.
do they?
Mean, they have to actually have 25 guys. Like, they don't have to be good, but.
But they don't, this is a world where the Padres are pulling Rule 5 guys out of rookie ball and low A and playing them all year. If you're already willing to go as scorched earth as they have, I mean, this is just such a nuke to whatever Marlins fans have already stuck it out this far. I mean, why would you?
Who's under Jeter? Has Jeter hired like a day-to-day guy?
I'm not sure. I've seen it speculated that they're holding off on doing that because they don't want all of this negative PR to attach to whoever winds up being the front office guy. But between the Marlins and now, Mark Carrig wrote an article today. He's a Mets beat writer about how Mets ownership is clearly slashing payroll again pretty severely, and they're not willing to discuss it with the media. That the Wilpons basically have been no commenting for like 3 or 4 years now. And so now you've got two what should be medium to large spending teams just artificially suppressed as bidders for players, and that's going to drive player salaries down. And yeah, that's I'd rather the players get money for their work than owners getting it for not really doing much. So
Right.
that's just sort of a macro level situation. One of the impacts of the Stanton trade seems to be, and maybe not, maybe this isn't related to the Stan trade, but the Orioles apparently are trying to trade Manny Machado, who's in the last year of his deal. And somehow the White Sox have gotten publicly, at least, tied up in that. And I was curious as to whether you had any opinions on that.
I think I've commented. I just don't feel like I understand, like, cutting Machado or cutting, like, it's one of those things where, like, whenever people say someone's untouchable, the answer is, with very few exceptions, that's not the case, because mostly that just means someone would have to make you a stupid offer. And so it seems like if someone's going to make them a stupid offer for Machado, they should take it. But that's true of any player,
Yeah.
basically. And then I just don't quite understand why they feel the need to make that trade otherwise, unless they're going to get a huge package back. But I don't know. I don't like the there's this I can't remember who it is. Someone on Twitter likes to I think likes to frame this as like bad teams are allowed to have good players. Like you as fans, we don't have to somehow root for this like weird allocation where like bad teams have all the prospects and good teams have all the good major leaguers.
Yeah.
Like there's it's the game is arguably more fun when you have like when you don't just have all of the good players getting traded. It's, as White Sox fans, we've seen it for sure, but sort of it's a little vulturous to sort of want this to happen. It's almost like rooting for, I don't know, like, hot companies to just get bought. Like it's, it makes sense. It's good for some of those people, but I don't have much of a take on the baseball end of it. It seems a little bit weird to suggest, like, I can't see the White Sox giving up anything of substance without a signed agreement. And the next free agent they sign that is of Manny Machado's caliber will be the first. So, who's the closest? I mean, the closest precedent would be Albert Bell.
And that was 20,
20
22
years ago.
years ago, something like that. 20, yeah.
And, and what, how old? Machado's 25?
Yeah.
And I think Bell was older, and obviously Bell was not a shortstop. Bell was not a good character guy. Machado's had his issues, but he's not Albert Bell. I know there's been some historical revisions on Albert Bell, but it's still, there's a difference. I'm also, it seems a little bit weird. Tim Anderson obviously is not the guy that you would 100% refuse to move, but, and they're not blocked in center field by any means, but trading for Machado, who has said he would really like to play short, means you're moving Anderson, who's, is compelling as a future major leaguer because he's, probably going to play above average shortstop. And so if you have to move him, you've taken some shine off of that.
Yeah, and a lot of the shine of Machado is that he's an elite defensive third baseman. I haven't really seen much of his play at short. From what I've read, he's good there, but I don't think it's like, he's not otherworldly there. I don't think he's not Lindor there, unless I'm mistaken. And while his bat is obviously more attractive at short than it is at third, it feels like it might be a little bit marginal in terms of the positional adjustment and then the defense you're sacrificing. I also am a little, I guess it freaks me out that he's had two major knee surgeries already. It freaks me out that his career on base percentage is like 329 or something like that. His bat is very good, but it's not, at least, and there's could still be development left there certainly at that age, but I think that he gets lumped in with Harper because they're going to hit free agency at the same time, and I think he's a degree removed from that caliber of player, to my mind. But yeah, it just feels very strange. It feels strange to me that a team in the White Sox position would be outbidding a team that could actually use Machado for a playoff push next year. Like you said, Anderson is somebody who you could displace for a superstar, but it also feels like a weird priority to upgrade a shortstop. You know, that would be, and you could say, well, maybe they've evaluated Anderson, don't think he's that great, but then why they just gave him an extension like 6 months ago. So
I don't think they gave him an extension before the year that was
yeah, it was
the very
troubling.
bad year.
Sure. But it'd be I don't know if they saw something this year that made them that was different. You know, this is what a bad Tim Anderson year was gonna look like.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I don't want to spend too much time poo-pooing it because the question of like, do you want Manny Machado on the White Sox is going to be a question about for how long and how much did you give up? And so, you know, if he gives up, you know, if Rick Hahn can swing it so that he's trading, you know, I don't know what would be leading the package. If it's, you know, topping out at one of the non-Kopech pitchers who's not at the majors yet,
Yeah,
you
like
know, if you can have
Hanson or
a if
Cease.
season Clarkin for Machado, you know, and a decent degree of confidence that you'll be able to get him signed, sure. Like,
Yeah.
now, I just find it difficult to believe that you'd win the bidding with season Clarkin.
Yeah, and it'd be weird to like I wrote about this on Twitter briefly, but it feels like all of the benefits of this trade are speculative or indirect. You know, what additional chance do you have of signing him based on having him in-house for half a year or a year? Are you flipping him for at the deadline? Are you going to get more at the deadline than you gave up for him in the first place? All of these things feel like very, it this just feels much harder than what your big move should be.
Yeah, I mean, right. I think it's in the same way that I want them to bid on Ohtani and I want them to put in a presentation for any given free agent.
Yeah.
I want them to be checking in on this in the same way that I assume every team was kicking the tires on Chris Sale. But, you know, a trade for guys who are really good,
Yeah.
typically a sign that it's a fair one, is that neither side is that the fans of the team, or the fans on both sides are worried they didn't get enough, and in this or gave up too much or whatever. And in this case, it seems like given that the upside is a lot more limited for in the immediate term, because it's you know it's I think it's possible that if they land, especially if they land in Machado, you know, it wouldn't be the weirdest thing that's ever happened if they backed into a wild card, but it's not worth burning a bunch of good talent to optimize that chance.
Yeah, and it seems like the type of thing where this is something I've been trying to write about, and it feels like it's going to become a big piece if I really do it properly. But it's sort of a pet theory of mine where, especially in this realm of people thinking it's this brilliant undiscovered territory to do scorched earth rebuilds and trade absolutely everything because you just take this concept of its lot to its logical ultimate conclusion, which is, hey, if I'm not going to win a championship this year, what good are any of these players doing me? Therefore, I should sell them all and so on, which, you know, has its attractive logic to it after a fashion. But one of the hidden costs of that is if you are as bad as the White Sox position themselves to be at the major league level and all these other teams, you One of the costs is that you aren't positioned to take advantage of opportunities. Like this time last year, you had no idea that like Derek Jeter and company were going to borrow like hundreds of millions of dollars and buy a team they couldn't afford and just be handing out all-stars for pennies on the dollar. And if you were where the White Sox were and you added just slap Marcell Ozuna onto that team, for example, and obviously I understand that like you may not have had the prospect capital to do that, but you're not even in the like you're taking these 20, 30, 40% chances of changing your fortune significantly because you're otherwise positioned to be pretty good and just dialing those all down to zero. And that adds up. I mean, if you knew like you didn't know Machado would be on the trading block necessarily. I mean, maybe you could have, you know, you look at the contract and say, hey, maybe the Orioles will not, you know, like their chances or whatever, but you're just
But
not
that's also, but the Orioles, I think without without Judge and, you know, the rest of the sort of like very positive returns on the Yankee side, plus the Red Sox really going for it, you know, and trading for Sale and whatnot. You know, I think without a, it's not that hard to see if you go back a year and a half or 2 years to say, why the hell would they trade Machado? You know, I
Yeah.
think they are really looking at that division and scared of it. I think that's what's driving this.
And I don't think they're, you know, necessarily crazy for doing that either. I don't think, you know, the Orioles operate differently than a lot of organizations, but I think it's a pretty easy to understand that thought process, pretty easy to follow. But, you know, regardless of the White Sox specifically or Machado specifically, this happens with, you know, for all that people act like the only way to rebuild a team in any sport is to tear it all the way down. I mean, the Celtics don't do that, and they're right there. They're in a position to, hey, Kyrie Irving went to, for some reason decided he didn't want to play with LeBron James, and now all of a sudden the Celtics were in a position where they just grabbed Kyrie Irving and threw him on a team that was already contending for a title. So,
Right.
this
Well, I
goes
mean, I
for.
think the Rockets are the even better example of that, which is that, you know, I don't know that Morey has ever made a move that was deliberately making his team worse in the short run. And certainly, you know, right, it's he just seems to try to want to make a, he's confident that any deal he can make, he can be 10% on the winning side. And he does that enough times, and now he's got the, depending on how you think of things, second or third best team in the league, right? So,
You can make a case for the best.
yeah, I don't think you can make much of a case, but yes.
Well, this the sample's not huge, but you know.
Yeah, in basketball in particular, I'm, especially after watching the Bulls, for, you know, being a Bulls fan and what that means. I am pretty open to the idea that you should have a ton of you. I'm sort of insistent on teams being a little bit proven. Like it, when you make a big change to your team, you got to see how it works in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Because playoff baseball is not really that different. Playoff basketball actually is that different. And so seeing, you know,
Yeah,
the
that's.
Thibodeau Bulls that looked great and then just, you know, ran out of gas or just like weren't good enough
Yeah.
to win a 7-game series. And the Warriors, you know, I basically until someone beats the Warriors, you know, like
Or, you know, I mean, the most obvious obstacle to the Warriors winning is the health of Steph Curry and Kevin Durant. I mean, they're,
yeah,
I mean,
no, of course.
not
And there's
to,
some, no,
yeah.
right, and that's one of the reasons to do this, right, to do what the Celtics and the Rockets do is that, you know, somebody on some other team can get hurt or some guy can blow up. You know, think about the 2017 White Sox had three or four big positive surprises, right? They had Avi and they had the bullpen. And, you know, from a certain point of view, they got nothing out of, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say this, but they didn't get a ton out of Avi. You know, the team outcome didn't change a whole ton for Avi having been good. And think about what had happened if they'd kept Sale and Quintana. You know, it wouldn't have been the same by any means. But, you know, you think about when you nuke a bunch of good players, it means that when some people turn out to be unexpectedly good, you've lost a shot, right?
Yeah, and some of that is the frustration of timing, right? Because if like Abisail, Lurie, and Yolmer do what they did last year, 1 year earlier,
And Canley and
which
Dvorak, yeah.
sure, yeah, it.
Which is, as far as I can tell, you know, Coop is very good at what he does. I'm still going to just say that's luck.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah. I mean, I guess it's how many percentage points of it do you want to attribute to luck, and how much do you want to, you know, give it to Cooper for, you know, nudging them to a position where they could get fortunate in that regard. Yeah, and I don't want to belabor the point too far, but it is. I think it's something that gets overlooked when people analyze roster construction and competition cycles, where like what are you're giving up more than just. You know, a couple players that, and you know, favorable contracts or however you want to look at it. But you know, at the same time, you got fortunate in the, you know, like, hey, you cashed in on Adam Eaton, and then he went and shredded his ACL. There is
Herm would have stopped that.
right there is this element. There is an element of risk mitigation, particularly in trading arms away, where you're saying, okay, we took Sale and we turned him into two potential stars instead of having all of our eggs in that one basket. Like, Mankata and Kopech could both be stars. Whether either of them's ever as good as Sale, that would be, that's pretty optimistic. But you
Right,
are.
the average number of minor leaguers at any given, right?
Yeah.
The number of minor leaguers who will ever be as good as Chris Sale, pitchers at any given in any given year is like
Maybe.
one or two.
Maybe. Yeah, and some years zero.
Right, some years zero.
So
And
no, but
yeah, if I had to pick someone currently in the minors that I think has the best shot of having a Sale-like career, it's probably, I'm not a prospect person. Kopech's probably in your top three.
yeah, it'd be like him, Reyes, and I'm blanking on someone big. But yeah, we'll find out what
And
the.
if you go for a strict and if you go for a strict upside play, then Hanson looks pretty good too, but like not that he is any not that he's at the level of those other guys, but just if you're thinking about someone who could potentially be that caliber, there aren't that many guys, but and the White Sox have their share of them. But
Yeah,
it
and
does it's always felt silly to me to be like, well, we're trading this guy who's a Cy Young winner in the hope that we get two stars who will combine to be slightly better than a Cy Young winner.
yeah, but like I was saying, there is an element of risk. You're trading risk
Sure.
types, right? Like as opposed, you're trading the risk of having all of your eggs in the Chris Sale basket, and God forbid he gets injured, versus the risk that Moncada and Kopech don't come anywhere close to their ceilings, which is a different kind of risk and a very real one. Like, these are both extremely hazardous potentials for all of those guys. It is not, I guess, Cease you could lump in too as a, I mean, he's even further away and there's a lot that could go wrong, but Cease does seem to have that ceiling in him as well. But what's crazy too is Sale was so good so fast that a lot of the time you're talking about minor leaguers who, like, when Sale was their age, was already like a number two starter or like a closer in the majors.
Right. I mean, he was a.
He threw what, like
I can
20 innings in the minors?
pull up his baseball reference page, but he got drafted as a junior and was, what, a very good reliever the next year in the
He
bigs?
was a very good reliever the same year.
Well, I mean, I was gonna not give him not like assess quality on the month or whatever he had of major league pitching that year, but
I mean, yeah, but
he didn't
like
look bad.
he
Yeah.
threw 23 innings and he had a, ERA under 2 and he struck out like a third of the batters
Sure.
he
Yeah, no,
faced,
you're right.
so.
He threw 23 innings with a I'm on baseball reference, so I have to use the dumb ERA plus, but 200, 225 ERA plus. It's pretty good.
Yeah, K percentage over a third, just looking at 92 batters faced, 32 strikeouts. Like, yeah, and it's, yeah, that's a small sample, but we're looking in hindsight, it was very real, obviously. So,
Yeah, and for the amount that people made fun of, like how ridiculous it is to like try to draft a, you draft right? Like I think it was fair to criticize there were the people saying like, did they just draft Birdie with the hope that he'd be in the majors? Like, and yeah, you shouldn't draft that way. And it was, it's pretty cool when someone like Finnegan does it, and then he doesn't turn out to be much or hasn't yet turned out to be anything like that. But right, Sale. They drafted him, and then he's never been anything but really, really good.
yeah. And I mean, the other thing too is, I mean, I guess it depends on what else you thought was there. Because Birdie, they took him, what, like 26th overall, something like that? It's not, relievers aren't glamorous in the draft. And if you're already a reliever when you're drafted, you don't have any fallback if you can't hack it. Failed starters become relievers, failed relievers become coaches. So, like, I mean, to me,
So there are
there's
guys who are college, I mean, not Birdie, right? But Dunning was not a Dunning was a swingman in college, right?
yeah, I mean, he was drafted
Like
to be a
right,
starter.
college coaches do stupid stuff, and so you have to assume that there is some. It's not common, but there are some guys who can move to a more desirable role in the pros than they were in college.
And there's varying degrees that I don't think Dunning was. I think the Florida coaching staff gets high marks from what I can tell, for how they handle pitching staffs. I mean, the thing with Dunning was that he was just behind on the depth chart behind some others.
I'm not saying it's the same by any means, but, you know, and it is, I think 98% of the time, it's a good heuristic to say, you know, in the same way that every July 2nd guy you see signed is a shortstop, a center fielder, or a catcher, regardless of, you know, and most of the, and, you know, half of those guys turn into first baseman, seemingly, you know, it is a bad sign when you, right? It's like Goldschmidt's like the only college first baseman or whatever that you see doing well.
Yeah, I know Michael Bauman wrote about how college first baseman is like this really grim demographic in terms of success. And that's part of it's just not having the fallback. And if you're already a first baseman in college, like how much athleticism do you have on your side? And there's exceptions to all of these things, obviously, like you said. I mean, Birdie as a pick, I was, you know, a little disappointed at the time just because college reliever, but the profile of the three guys they took at the top of the draft in Collins, Birdie, and Hanson together is kind of a cool blend of risk and proximity. I mean, Birdie, I mean, there is an element of risk cutting that you're doing by the fact that Birdie was going to be a, like, if you think he's going to be a fast mover and they're already close to the majors, there is an element of, well, there's, you know, less that can go wrong between now and him arriving. Obviously, Tommy John is like a very common thing for guys who throw 100.
But you sort of got to worry about any, like, anybody who's got the stuff to be worth drafting in the top two rounds. I'm not a mechanicist, but anybody who's got this, you know, anybody who's got first, second, third round stuff, you probably got to worry about TJ.
Totally. I think I, this was years ago, and who knows if this held up, but I remember reading an orthopedic surgeon or something like that, where he was like, yeah, I mean, there's lots of stuff you can do to try to, you know, for injury prevention. And, but at a certain point, like the harder you throw, it exerts that much more force on the ligaments in your elbow. And, you know, you do them. That's, it's kind of a, something you can't get around. Like that's,
I'm going to mess the details of this up, but I think the, at least this year's Sabre seminar and maybe years in the past, there's like, so Sabre seminar, I guess for the listeners who aren't aware, is an annual sort of like, I think it's Sabermetric Scouting in the Science of Baseball is the tagline. And so it's, there's people from front offices and there's doctors and there's scouts and there's nerds like me getting up and talking. And I'm pretty sure that there was like a DPT, like a physical therapist type guy who does a lot of sports medicine, and a sports medicine doctor, and an orthopedic surgeon, and maybe like a couple non-medical people who've done a lot of research in this area. And they all give talks over the 2 days, and there's one person saying that it's, you know, sliders, and one person saying it's not sliders, and one person saying it's velocity, and another person saying it's not velocity, it's workload. And like nobody really commented on this, that you have these guys who are, you know, and they have the professional credentials, and Lord knows I do not, but you know, there are some people out there of varying degrees of qualifications who seem, you know, pretty convinced about what is or is not driving some of this stuff. And I guess this is a reminder to me that I should go read the Jeff Passan book, but in general, you know, I haven't, just because people disagree doesn't mean that nobody knows, but in this case, it suggests that nobody knows.
Yeah. Or, I mean, to be a lame attorney and just sort of muddle things into the middle and just say, like, there's clearly a lot of variables at play here and they all probably play some part. I was talking to a friend of mine who's,
that's astonishingly unattorney-like. Attorneys tend to want single causal explanation.
Well, it depends on the audience.
Yeah, no, I'm just teasing. From my years of doing data analysis, where the attorneys want the simple answer, and the economists are like, "No, it's not that simple."
Well, if
the economists don't want to simplify it, then you know.
Attorneys want simple answers, but they will not give simple answers. So
it also depends on if they're defense or prosecution or plaintiff side, I guess.
That is also true. but last night I was speaking to I guess he was an ER doctor, and now he's a toxicologist, but general medical man. And he was telling me about how there are all these new, I don't even know how new, studies and experiments that they've been doing about monitoring hydration within muscles, and that they're able to, a dehydrated muscle is apparently more susceptible to injury, which is not surprising, and how sports teams and things like that are trying to get better at monitoring that and modulating workloads and hydration and things like that. So there's that aspect to it. I remember reading that, and who knows, right? Like, I remember reading that Chris Sale was like absurdly flexible, which makes sense from watching him pitch. And who knows what that, maybe that reflects some attribute of his soft tissue where he's less susceptible to injury, despite everyone screaming from draft day that he would get injured immediately. Like, his only injury to date is he had some like random elbow soreness at one point, and he had an avulsion fracture in his foot, I think, and that's kind of it. And otherwise, he's just thrown 200 innings a year every year. So,
There was that time where Kenny tried to send it back to the bullpen.
yeah, and that was, I think that was the elbow soreness thing. Like, he had some minor, aches.
I guess my last comment on this little digression is that my experience as someone who is like reasonably well versed in data and who is my current occupation spends a lot of time thinking about data and medicine. Despite being only moderately trained, is that there's most medical studies in general are very, or tons and tons of them are very questionable,
Yeah, that makes
because it's
sense.
so hard to get decent sample size. And in the case of sports, it's really hard to randomize. And then any study, most studies also don't take into account differential effects. This is something that, I guess, for the statsy people listening, if you know Andrew Gelman does a good job talking about this. He's a Columbia stats professor. But that, people typically say, like, well, it's a 20% increase. And it can be a 20% increase on average. That means for some people it's 30, and for some people it's a 10% the other way. And that, when people talk about stuff like weighted balls, it's like, I'm sure weighted balls help some people and hurt some people. And
Yeah.
until you can. I'm not going to be, and it's probably worth doing the thing that's on average better, but you got to be flexible.
Yeah, and that's a really, that point's really well taken. I'm always, especially with something as complicated as the human body and health, not being an expert at all, I do try to take a lot of that with a grain of salt in the sense of, well, how well are they going to be able to control for a lot of variables here? Like, for the individual involved, and that seems colossally difficult to do. I'm sure there are things you can do to help with that, but like you said, and then on top of the other issues you're talking about sample size and things like that. So, who knows? I mean, you read stories about, and a lot of the time too, you get this sort of confirmation bias effect with pro athletes because the guys who, obviously, the ones who had long major league careers are the ones who avoided the worst injuries. And so you say, okay, well, what did Bartolo Colon do? And what did some of these other guys do? And, maybe there's some benefits you can glean from there, but it could just be that, he was one of the lucky ones.
Well, in Cologne's case, I think there's a couple pretty ironclad things that got him in some trouble that I assume contributed. But yeah, and so on top of that, the last piece is that you can't do studies on pro athletes, which means that the studies always end up getting done on high schoolers who throw 75. And what do you like? How exactly? Those people are categorically different from the like 300 people in the world that are good enough to be major league pitchers. Or
Yeah.
I don't know if I did that math right. I don't think I did. Let's say 500 people who are good enough to be major league pitchers.
Of varying quality. For sure. Other than that, I guess I'm trying to think of what other topics we should address before we wrap up. The other news is not White Sox adjacent. It's Jack Morris and Alan Trammell were added to the Hall of Fame by Veterans Committee. I've long thought that Trammell should be in. I've long thought Jack Morris should not. And I know two wrongs don't make a right, but do you think it's fair to say that Mark Burley was like a much better pitcher than Jack Morris?
Yeah, I mean, well, they're differently good, right? Because Burley is like one of the things that I wish there was more formal recognition of, and this is sort of what people get at with the Hall of Very Good, but that Burley is like an incredibly interesting pitcher in the sense that he was, there were five or six or eight things or something where he was either the best or the worst in the league. You know, he was probably like, he was the best at controlling the running game.
Yep.
He was the best at working quickly. He was the best at durability. He was the best at fielding, you know, all of these like plus minus. He was, you know, had the about the worst velocity of like, you know, starters who were going when he was.
Certainly the second half of his career. I think
Yeah, for sure. Right.
earlier.
Not to say that he, right. I mean, as with most guys who have the rep for not having amazing stuff, it's that they had good stuff and then it got worse, and the other and
Yeah.
everything else made them better that remained. But you know, so I like to believe that there's some room for, so there's some way of recognizing Burley. And I'm not super opposed to the concept of like a two-tier Hall of Fame, which is basically that you can come, I think one version of this, or maybe three-tier, which is basically if you're good enough to be on the ballot, then I think it's appropriate that you show up in some way when someone goes to the museum. And then if you're good enough to get a pretty small fraction of the vote, then you should get more. And then there's the people who are actually very good. And so I'd like Morris and Burley to be in that second category.
Yeah.
You
It's
know, I think more interested in baseball history than a lot of people who, you know, yak about baseball. I think that's a function of my having spent an absurd amount of time reading baseball history books when I was nine. But and so and which actually the White Sox connection there is that it means that for all the things I don't like about Hawk, I'm gonna be sad that there are gonna he I really like that he talks about baseball that happened more than 5 or 10 years ago.
totally.
And
That's
so I want to preserve that. You know, baseball does allow comparisons in a way that few sports do of players across eras. But yeah, I mean, from a strictly quality perspective, I don't like Jack Morris shouldn't be in,
well,
given the way we've currently built the hall.
what's frustrating too is that, you know, you read these stories about how horrible he was to female reporters as well, and it's like, certainly in this moment, it feels even more, it kind of clangs in the ear, so to speak, a little bit more that
Has he ever apologized or anything?
oh no, absolutely not.
Okay. Because it is the sort of thing where, you know, I'm willing to grant that it is true that that stuff happened 30 years ago, which doesn't mean it was 100% wrong, and it's not something that an apology fixes. But I think it's worth considering that. But, you know, if he doesn't care, then that is even worse.
I mean, it was a mercy to me that he went it that it was the same panel that put Alan Trammell in, but it's also like it's strange to me that so much of Jack Morris's candidacy hinged on his just sort of like being on good teams, and that, you know, so much of his success came with the Detroit Tigers, and like the two best players on all those Tigers teams were Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker,
Whitaker
and
wasn't even on the ballot, right?
Lou Whitaker fell off after 1 year.
But I think he wasn't even on this, like, whatever they're
Oh,
calling the Veterans Committee ballot,
no, I don't think he was.
which is insane to me. The
Right.
idea that you would be trying to put Trammell up there and not, like, you know, they retired when I was a kid. I didn't, you know, I don't think I have any memories of watching either of them. But you know, Trammell and Whitaker. It's like having a ballot that, you know, nominates John Hall and not Darryl Oates. Like, you know, maybe one of them's carrying the, maybe one of them was a little better, but
Depending on how you slice it, the different valuation metrics, I think they were remarkably close, and some have one over the other, and vice versa. Like just looking at Baseball Reference, it has Whitaker ahead of Trammell. I think off the top of my head, I think Baseball Prospectus has them flipped. I mean, granted, like some positions just get screwed when it comes to the Hall of Fame.
third
Shortstop.
base.
Yeah, third base, and second base is probably not too far behind. Although there are some historic players that may shift that. I don't, you know, I don't know what's going on in people's hearts, but I, you know, one of these players is white, and the other's a minority, and you know, or two of the, I guess Morris as well. I mean,
When
But
Tremel is stuck around the game, I think.
yeah, I mean, Tremel was a manager. He I think he managed that Tigers team that lost like 120 games or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. It just doesn't feel great. It doesn't feel great that like Dick Allen and Minamino didn't get in on the Veterans Committee yet. It feels like a wrong that should be corrected.
Yeah, well, and I think, and I'm imagine this was racialized. I think there are a bunch of stories about Whitaker being a space cadet. I think there's a story about him. He showed up to an All-Star game without a uniform and had to play with stuff they got at the concession stand in the park.
Jesus.
Which I'm imagine this is the sort of thing that this is definitely the sort of thing, as with, going back to Albert Bell. All this stuff plays very differently when you're not white.
Well, yeah, I mean, Bill James writing like the biggest hit piece on Dick Allen stands out to me as like a black mark that makes me question like Bill James's legacy as a whole, like in and of itself. Like the fact that he basically blamed Dick Allen for the racism of Alabama and Philadelphia in the 60s is very troubling to me. There are on the field reasons to argue against Dick Allen as a Hall of Famer in terms of longevity, and his defense was obviously not a strength. But like Edgar Martinez is probably going to get in. And Mark and I already talked Edgar Martinez to death on the last podcast, but like it's just so weird to me that these guys aren't getting in, and guys like Jack Morris are, and that's just it. It diminishes my enjoyment of it. Granted, having been to the Hall of Fame now, I mean they do a really good job of documenting a lot of players who aren't quote in the Hall of Fame in the museum portion, which is extensive and very good. Like Minoso's all over the Hall of Fame. He's just not in, for
Right.
example.
No, and I think that's bizarre, right? Is that there's, I don't know how much, White Sox Hall of Famer George Davis, I don't know how much he's actually shows up in the museum. I haven't been to the museum since, 20 years, I think.
Oh, wow.
I've been every winter. I talk about driving up to Cooperstown with a buddy of mine around here, and we still haven't done it. So I got to do it sometime soon. But
It's right by the Omegang Brewery as well.
yeah, right. There used to be two things in Cooperstown, because there's like a farming museum, I think, and now there's three. But
Yeah, I mean it's something that hopefully, I mean I unfortunately we lost Minoso before he got inducted. I'm sure eventually he'll get in some way. Dick Allen is a fun follow on Twitter.
I did not know Dick Allen was on Twitter.
He is. I'm not sure how much of it is him directly or, someone managing it for him, but he like wishes happy birthday to former teammates and stuff. And periodically he'll retweet or like, something about his career. He's
He's not verified, however.
that'd be really weird to fake, to pretend that you're Dick Allen.
I think Dick Allen might take over as my favorite sort of like very prominent person that I wouldn't expect to be on Twitter. Unfortunately, it looks like his Twitter is very conventional.
Yeah, no, he's
It,
not doing
his,
anything
his main
weird.
competition is like Sherman Alexie mostly tweets about basketball.
I don't know who that is.
He's a very he's probably the most prominent Indigenous American fiction writer.
Oh. Check that out.
So he's written a bunch of short fiction, and he tweets some about that, but he was like a pretty serious Sonics fan, so he will like hate he apparently quit Twitter, I see, looking on his feed. He would like hate tweet Thunder games.
That's so good. That's so good. It's always fun to see like super talented people who clearly have a lot going on, like feeling the same sort of like petty hate watching like sports thought processes that that I feel. They're just like us.
Yeah, so I guess I'm now reading his feed. It wasn't quite as much in the same. It wasn't quite as much talking about the like sports as I expected. But I think the ideal for Twitter is that it's people who are prominent for politics talking about sports and not vice versa.
Yeah. Just to quickly wrap up, I wanted to get your thoughts. Mike Musari, a contributor, wrote an article this past week, sort of also ruminating on further potential fallout from Stanton suddenly, just getting plopped down onto the Yankees. I think the Yankees now have like eight outfielders or something, because they obviously have Judge and Stanton, but they also have Brett Gardner, Aaron Hicks, Jacoby Ellsbury's owed a ton of money for a while, and Clint Frazier is, a pretty widely like a well-regarded prospect who was breaking into the majors last year, just to name a few. And Musari was thinking, hey, if the Yankees need to get rid of Ellsbury's contract, the White Sox should volunteer to take on that money, and for their troubles, the Yankees should hand over a prospect, possibly Frazier, or someone else. They got a lot of guys. I don't know. I was curious as to whether obviously Ellsbury's no trade clause is like the biggest obstacle to that, even if the teams agree they wanted to do that. But I wanted to get your thoughts on the general shape of that, specifically Ellsbury. But if you think that the White Sox should still be doing that sort of thing.
I don't think I have any objection to them doing it. I'd be in favor of it. The kick, right, it's not my money, like, is the thing that complicates this. This is easy for me to say. Red Jerry has demonstrated a lack of willingness to an increased willingness over the last couple of years, but still nothing along the lines of what is functionally buying a prospect.
Right.
And I'm not compelled by any of their center field options except Lurie, and feel like you should be able to find playing time for Lurie anyhow.
I mean, yeah.
And so I'm all in favor of the Whites. The White Sox haven't eaten any money, I think, in the interest of getting prospects, like, ever that I can think of, really. And so I would want them to do it, and it seems like a reasonable opportunity. But I don't. Yeah, that's where I land. Is if this were possible, I'd be all for it.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on all that. I think as a general principle, it'd be nice. I mean, just a quick comment on the it isn't my money thing. I mean, yeah, like I think, baseball revenues have exploded. Owners are getting a higher and higher percentage of revenues relative to the players, which I think should be corrected. That's just how I don't think it's healthy for because I think, like, for example, at the time of the 94 strike, it was over, they were hovering around 50-50 or something like that, and they were fighting over percentage points on there. I think, and I'd have to check, I've seen some people speculate that something like 60-40 or higher in favor of the owners at this point.
Yeah, I think I had read that it had gone maybe from 60-40 to 40-60. And yeah, my point with that is not that I'm a, team should be public trusts, right? I don't see why the Yankees aren't like the Metropolitan Museum. But I know that's like me and Bauman and some of the other avowed, lefty weirdos on baseball Twitter with that opinion. So
Oh, but
I think they sh like it's not that I'm saying that that makes it a bad move. I'm just saying that any move that is contingent on asking a guy who has not demonstrated the willingness to throw down money for speculative impact, that spending a bunch of time analyzing something that is entirely contingent on Reinsdorf deciding to put money down or not, for that is much more aggressive in terms of throwing the cash around than he's ever been. Seemed I just like don't want to.
Oh yeah.
I want to. I want to raise that it seems a little weird to talk about it an out of character move,
It totally
not
is.
not to immunize him from criticism.
There's that element of it, but part of what I was driving at with the, it's not my money, and I see that people talking about moves all the time that way. But the problem is whether they should or shouldn't, owners put limits on how much they're willing to spend on player payroll. And if Ellsbury or whatever contract they do sign takes up too much of that and prevents them from using that money in better ways to improve the team, then it is a problem, regardless of whether it's my money or not. I'd be worried that Ellsbury would be enough bad money that maybe it becomes an impediment. Maybe it's more than Clint Frazier's worth. Frazier, I feel like, has always kind of underperformed like a little bit relative to his like his performance has not quite matched up to the hype, to the projection so far. But maybe, maybe it's that's maybe it's worth it. Maybe you get, a bench outfielder slash, second division center fielder in Ellsbury, and you get a average or better corner outfielder in Frazier, all for the, price of whatever that's worth. So, thought it was interesting. I mean, I can't see them making too many other big moves. I mean, the Wellington Castillo contract seemed like a situation where they just saw that he could be had for an amount and time period that they thought was worth it, and they just pulled the trigger on it. And I thought that was, I thought it was a solid signing, but
Yeah, and I think out of like bordering on Stockholm syndrome slash wanting it to be true, I like Narvaez a lot.
same.
I'm not bothered at all by signing another catcher.
No, yeah, I like Narvaez a lot. He's a cool player. He's fun. He's weird.
He's right. He's a little bit in the sense that I was saying,
He's
like Bailey's
burly,
a very strange shape. He's
yeah.
Narvaez is also a very strange shape.
Well, yeah, he's like what, like a he's like a they don't really do this, but he's what, like a 70 like batter's eye and like a 20, he's like 20 or 20 power. And it's like
Yeah,
what?
he's right. He's like a 20. He's a 25 or 30 power guy.
But then he plays catcher, and it's like if he can sustainably have an on base of like 350 to 370 at catcher, like does it matter that he doesn't do anything else? Like I don't know. It might not. But
The
oh
other
it
thing with the Ellsbury deal is that I this gets kicked around, and it's something I've never seen a real answer to, is whether there are owners who are willing to say, I'm not spending 20 million this year, but I'm going to grant you 20 million plus interest to spend next year. Like knock your payroll up with the amount that, right, I'm going to put this 20 million in a CD. Obviously you don't actually do that, but and in that case, if we're talking about 25 million for Ellsbury over the next couple of years, if that were to complicate, for instance, I might rather they sit on that and then spend it on Mach and then up their offer for Machado by that much next year.
Yeah, and that was something that always kind of bothered me, for all that I went on my long rant about contention cycles being misapplied in some respects. There's also the fact that for years when the White Sox were quote unquote going for it, like regardless of the situation, they kind of had a flat payroll, right? Like it was somewhere between 100 and $125 million every year, no matter what, like whether they were going to be good or bad. And they just weren't going to go above that, and they weren't ever going to go on this floor. And, they've obviously cut their payroll considerably over the last year plus. And I'd be very interested to see if they're willing to go even relative to the league higher than they were before when it looks like they might be good again, because you're clearly not, what happens to all this money they don't spend? Obviously some of it went to like Robert, which was not nothing, but that actually basically got wiped out by the every owner just got $50 million for advanced media, I think. So that's actually kind of a wash, which is nice. But yeah,
Well, yeah.
there's
I
the
mean,
I don't, but I
again,
will,
it's like, could you sit on that 50 million and turn it into 70 million in 2 years? I don't know what Reinsdorf is invested in or what his returns are or whatnot, right? I think the analysis, this, and there is definitely some truth that I think there's a little bit of sort of like arbitrage that owners do. That's where all the deferred money comes from. The Bobby Bowe deal, one, I don't think is unreasonable, but it's certainly extremely reasonable if you have access to the returns that extremely honest investment manager Bernie Madoff was generating. You would 100, any owner who has paid any attention to financial engineering would 100% take the money, defer the money and put it in something that's returning 8 or 10%.
Yeah, I mean the Nationals have been trying desperately to get players to free agents to sign on like deferred salaries, and they largely don't want to do it. And for all that the Bobby Bonilla thing is funny, when people bring it up, because it's like, oh man, they're still paying this guy from who hasn't played in forever. It was still a good deal. Like it's objectively like cheaper for the team.
Yeah,
So,
it did. I think my two favorite sort of things that are entirely about framing things questionably is I believe there was a year, the year after the Jason after Jason Bay left the Mets. I believe the two highest paid Mets outfielders were Bobby Bo and Jason Bay. Which is in the same vein as the joke that unfortunately only stayed relevant for 1 year was that New Yankee Stadium and Wrigley Field had in common that neither team had won while they since they'd moved in. I was really hoping I could get more than 1 year out of that joke, and I didn't.
my new stat on that is because Derek Jeter is getting paid $5 million a year, and I think that makes him currently 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the seventh highest paid player on the team,
On
on the Marlins. And if Starlin Castro gets traded as expected, I mean, Ziegler and Tozawa are ahead of him barely. Those guys are free agents after this year, so I assume they either get dealt or, you know, Jeter's making more. I mean, you're looking at if they trade Yelich, those free agents go and they don't like sign anybody worth more than that, which they might not do. You're looking at the highest paid players on the Marlins next year being Wei-Yin Chen, number one, Martin Prado, number two, and then Derek Jeter, number three, which is very possible. And yeah, so that might
So
be.
he's taking a $5 million salary.
Yeah, he
I didn't
invests.
realize that GM salaries are public.
So I don't know how this got out there, but I've seen in multiple places that he basically, his ownership stake is very small. He put in $25 million and he's getting it paid back to him over 5 years. So like he basically just is a quote owner for like for free, and also just for like
Well,
dragging
and for the value
and
of his
for
labor.
and dragging his legacy through the mud, such as it is. White Sox.
Did they, do you know if they did? So all the stuff about how they, I have read conflicting things, or maybe I just didn't understand them, about whether it was Loria or the new owner who ran up all the debt that they're trying to, that is necessitated, and I put that word in quotes, this teardown.
I don't know. The 400 million number gets thrown around a lot. I think it was debt taken on to purchase the team. I mean, because theoretically, right? Like, if I'm selling the team and I have $400 million in debt or something like that, like, wouldn't that get priced into the purchase? You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah,
how
I
am I
mean, I think
selling the team
oh,
for one
these are
point?
such weird sort of, you can think of them as teams as assets or, you know, financial instruments or whatever. They're very strange, and so I know the details. But
But like, if I have $400 million in debt, plus there's debt service on that, but like, if I'm selling a team for 1.6 billion, isn't it? Shouldn't I just be selling it for? Doesn't it mean that it's worth that plus the debt? Like, if that's what it's being sold for?
yeah, no, it's mostly just a question of like how they finance this deal and how much cash is put down and who it's going to
I know that the new owners took out at least, and I'm sure that there's like all kinds of pieces to this, but I know that they have about a hundred. They took out $175 million loan that needs to be paid back over 3 years at 14% interest. And
that's a
that,
lot.
and it's like if you do the math on what they need to cut their payroll by over the next 3 years, that like, that kind of fits very nicely in terms
Which
of.
that starts to resemble the rumors about that there is some like VP or MD at JP Morgan who was looking at every trade the Mets were talking about doing during
Oh yeah, while the
whichever who what was the was it Zach Wheeler for Carlos Gomez? Is that the one that got squashed? Am I remembering that correctly?
because they traded for Cespedes instead of Gomez, right?
Yeah, something like that. Anyhow, there were like very concrete rumors that these were getting run through like their creditors.
They had to, I think they had to get deals approved. I don't know
Yeah,
about.
no, their creditors were saying like, no, you can't take on that financial obligation.
Yeah, it's. I mean the Mets situation is very depressing, but
Right. Which, for the amount that, you know, if you're thinking about the owner that has gotten fired, in any sport was for being, you know, just an all-around horrible monster. That'd be Sterling.
yeah.
And, you know, it's possible that there's one or two guys in the NFL that are starting to edge that direction.
Yeah,
But you'd figure that if there's
Richardson.
one thing that you'd push the team out, that you'd push the ownership out for, it's not having enough money to actually run the team.
Right, but then there's that really cynical calculus of like it's good for the owners in a way to I mean it sucks that you're like flushing revenue sharing down the toilet on these guys, and you're just, losing huge markets of potential revenue. But at the same time, like, the not having the Marlins and Mets as bidders on any free agents ever is like drives down player salaries, and the owners are probably, based on history, are probably very interested in that. I can't speak for them, but
Yeah, I can't imagine that actually that the I think they should be much more interested in growing revenue rather than reducing cost.
I mean, I agree, and they probably, I mean, to them, they were probably just much more excited to get like Jeter's face on that, but like that also feels silly given, say, yeah, like people love Jeter, but I don't know that Marlins fans do, and clearly, like, if they're gonna start on this sort of footing, like, God, like, it seems to do seems not to be worth the trouble, other rather than just selling it to somebody who actually can afford the team.
Yeah, all these shenanigans start to sound like what you read about Bill Veeck doing. And like those stories in his book are kind of charming, but they also happened 65 years ago. And back when the industry wasn't particularly well capitalized, and Veeck wasn't sitting on massive piles of money. And you know what? He had to move his team. So, you know.
You're not going to get me to criticize Bill Veeck. That's not, unless I learn something new
Oh
about
no,
him.
I'm not. I'm not. He's done things. He definitely did some things that, in retrospect, didn't age super well. But no, I'm just saying that like his book is super charming, but it is not particularly charming to read someone trying to play it back in 2017.
I still haven't
Now,
read it. I need to
my
go do
grandparents
that.
live in the same like retirement community as his wife, who's apparently a very nice woman.
I mean, I haven't read the book, so I don't know a lot of the details. I do know that Vec tried to integrate the league really, really hard for a long time, which goes a long way for me.
Oh yeah, no. I mean,
But
and he was right. I believe he tried to buy, I think, the Phillies,
yeah.
and was just extremely open about how he was just going to go sign the whole Negro Leagues and,
He was gonna make it like a new,
roll
yeah, the
roll the
Negro League
whole
All-Star
league.
team, and
And Landis told him to, and they all told him to pound sand.
Google image search Mountain Landis. It's like he's like central casting for the villain in these stories.
Well,
But
also, his name is Kennesaw Mountain. I believe he's named after the Civil War battle
I
that
think
his
so.
dad fought in.
Jesus.
Because, I mean, among other things, that's like fun thing about how old this is that like, he was a judge in 1920, so he is an old white guy. And I'm pretty sure he's named after he was born Kennesaw Mountain Landis was born in 1866.
Jesus.
And oh, so his dad maybe was he was born in Ohio, so his dad was probably fighting on the Union side, but he's still named after a Civil War battle. Not a great sign.
No, certainly in tandem with his track record. But I'm running out of time here, unfortunately. I gotta go pack for gotta pack for New Zealand. But I guess the last piece of news is the White Sox made it through Rule 5 unscathed. I don't think they had anybody taken from them. Apparently, the two guys that they wanted at the number 4 pick were both gone, so they just drafted Carlos Tochi, who I think was in his third Rule 5 draft or something like that. And
He's the Rule 15er, yes.
yeah, and, so, and sold him to Texas. So it wound up being uneventful because I know a lot of people were wringing their hands about Jake Peter and Jordan Guerrero. I mean, I guess the answer of, in tandem with the White Sox leaving them exposed and them not getting selected, perhaps we should, maybe perhaps we are overvaluing those who are concerned about them being taken, we're overvaluing them relative to the people who would know a little bit better. But
Yeah,
by which I
the
mean
thing
the
is, a prospect
organization's
can
not
be
like,
very good and or it can be pretty good and not really worth rule fiving.
yeah. And by I want to clarify when I say people who know better, I mean like Major League front offices. I'm not talking about like me, but
Correct.
because that could sound really snotty. But yeah, Frank, thanks so much for joining me on this Sunday afternoon. Do you have anything in the works, or I guess we'll keep. A lot of us are kind of in a holding pattern until something happens, I guess.
On the baseball side, I do not have anything in the works.
Yes. But well, I won't reveal any details of your personal life that you don't want to reveal, but I wish you the best of luck over the coming weeks.
Yes. Enjoy your I guess, well, I can bring it up because it's got the podcast connection, is that we, I feel like we should get sponsorship from Cavern. So
we definitely should. I should talk to them about that. Next time I'm in Williamsburg, for sure.
There's probably a ton of intersection between, you know, Instagram popular, you know, feminist jewelry stores in New York City and our listenership. So
I think so. And we should, a triple brand alliance with us and the restaurant in Nashville.
Yeah, for sure.
Well,
you and I can go wearing our jewelry and then, and ask for a break on a tasting menu or whatever.
I love it. I love it. This is why, you know, you got that, that expertise. So, fantastic. Frank, it's been a pleasure. I'll talk to you real soon.
And have a good trip.
Thanks, bud. All right.
Bye.